Outdoor Explorer. I'm your host, Lisa Keller. In last week's show on the Stewart Trail, I interviewed Jeff Landfield and Paxson Welber from the Alaska Landmine. Our conversation covered the early history of the trail, the beginning of the dispute centered around a new landowner, and the current legal standing of trail access. In the second part of the story, I interview two homeowners who live a short distance from the trail. The first half of the show is with Chris Reynolds, the treasurer of the Friends of the Stewart Public Trail, a group that successfully sued to reopen the trail to public access. The second half of the show is with Kelly Becker, a trail-adjacent homeowner who originally sided with the new landowner to close the trail to public access, but is now working with the Friends of the Stewart Public Trail as a member of the Stewardship Committee. Both offer unique perspectives on the impact of trailheads on the narrow hillside roads and how to work together to defend public and private land. Welcome to Outdoor Explorer, Chris.
Thanks, Lisa. Thanks for having me.
Yeah. First of all, let's just start about telling me about the Friends of the Stewart Public Trail and what's it all about and how it started.
So Friends of the Stewart Public Trail is a nonprofit, and so it started because this Stewart Trail, which is in Upper Potter Valley, a bunch of years ago in 2015, actually, a newish landowner, put up some barricades and essentially was discouraging people from going on the trail. And so a group of us, it became apparent that there needed to be some advocacy and some challenge to that assertion that the public didn't have any right. And the Friends kind of was born out of that coalescence of people that were concerned.
Did it start at the community council level first? Like this discussion of the Stewart Trail, like, hey, we've had access closed off to this.
No, I think it started probably in different homes, in different, I think it started in multiple different ways and then kind of came together. These different people that were having these concerns and conversations kind of came together around the Friends group. And then the Friends group, of course, showed up, or some of us from the Friends group showed up at the community council meetings, but there wasn't really a whole lot that could be or was done at that community council level.
Okay. And so when this all first went down, you live like steps from the trail. Uh-huh. And did you just one day show up and then there's this big barrier on the trail?
No, I think initially there were just some new signs that said no trespassing. And that was just a real diversion from what had ever been there. It was a little bit ambiguous because it said no trespassing and then it said enter at your own risk. So, we weren't really sure what that meant. So that went on for, I don't really know how long, but those signs just existed and everybody was just sort of wondering what was going to go on. And then in 2015, that's when the real barricading and the barbed wire and the real sort of physical force effort to keep people out manifested.
So the land was purchased in 2012. So there were about 3 years where it was kind of like you could still get through there. And because there had been a gate there before to stop vehicle traffic, right?
Yeah. So originally, way back in the day, there used to be cabins up there. I think there were like 6 or 8 cabins up there. And people would come from Anchorage because this was not really part of Anchorage back then, And I think people, probably kids, I don't know, wasn't around then, would drive back there or go back there and have parties and stuff. And those 6 cabins were actually burned down one summer. Mm-hmm. And arson went back there and all six, I think there's 6 or 4 or 8 cabins, they were all lost one summer. And so at some point after that, that red gate that we all knew got put in. But there was a 3-foot sort of corridor around that gate that you could walk. or ski or bike or, you know, whatever, snowshoe. And that's what we all knew as the Red Gate, you know?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Okay. So a bunch of you around in this area, but not all of you, because there were people that said, yeah, we want it closed off, not just the landowner, right?
Yeah, for sure. Yeah.
So what kind of vibe did that create in your community? Was there a lot of division around that, or were there people like, well, let's just agree to disagree, or what was happening during that time with the neighborhood?
Yeah. You know, it's funny. I was just talking with my wife, Janice, about that the other day. We remember sitting at our table and writing letters to, I think, 250 of our neighbors, only a small handful we'd ever met, you know, when this started, and saying, you know, hey, what are your feelings about this? And what's your history of use? Because we're trying to get a sense for what was going on. And we had some long discussions writing those letters, because we knew that, you know, we'd probably make some enemies, or we'd probably have some neighbors that were not going to be very happy with us. But we also knew we were going to probably, you know, make some pretty deep friendships, or draw, you know, the other half of the people closer to us. And unfortunately, I think that's pretty well played out. You know, mm-hmm. I think about half the folks around here, you know, would rather not have public access, and half the people are pretty adamant that it's a public trail and it should be open to the public.
So what are the main concerns about not having public access? I mean, what was happening before that public access was controlled? What was happening before that was bothering the neighbors?
I think just things that are typical whenever you have a trailhead, you know. You know, parking was an issue there. That's actually a real issue. There aren't any established parking spaces here. And so, you know, people would just park where they could. And sometimes where they could park was not very helpful for people that you know, owned driveways around here. You know, some people would, you know, leave trash or not pick up their dog poop, and just stuff you'd, you know, see if you go to Flat Top.
Yep. It's really everywhere in Anchorage. There are problems like that, but I think there, to me, because I've been up there, and there is like a legitimate safety concern in terms of if there was a bunch of parking going on there, it'd be hard for like fire trucks to get through, right?
Yeah, for sure. And it might be getting a little ahead of ourselves, but now that's the task at hand. That's the largest task at hand for the Friends group, is to coordinate with you know, the concerned neighbors, you know, the traffic engineers and the fire department, to see, hey, people are coming, so how do we do this in a way that's mindful and safe and planful?
Mm-hmm. Okay, so you sent out all these letters, so you're kind of getting a feel for your community that you're living in, and then you find out who the people are that agree with you that this that there should be public access. And again, you are pretty much as close to the trail as anybody else, except for maybe one other owner who's like right there.
Yeah,
maybe a couple
of houses closer. Yeah.
Yeah. But it's like a 1 minute walk from your house. So yeah. you are impacted by all these things. So you find the like-minded people and you create this Friends of the Stewart Public Trail group. And then what was your next thing that you did once you kind of formed up together?
Well, those surveys went to Alaska Trails, and Alaska Trails agreed to be the sort of the body that just sort of received those and processed data so that we could have some information about the history of use there. That was after we initially met with Tom Meacham, and there was no Friends group yet. But that was after we met with Tom Meacham, who has been one of our lawyers and just a wonderful support and asset for us. And he was the one who told us, well, actually, you can't do that. You know, he was the first one to help us understand, you know, that actually might not be legal here in Alaska, but you need to know, you know, you need to figure out what the history of use is so that you can know sort of how the law applies.
So what do you mean wouldn't be legal to try to keep public access through there might not be legal?
Yep. Yeah. Okay, under he was saying under certain conditions, according to Alaska law, you cannot shut down public access on even across a private lot under certain conditions. So you need to figure out whether those conditions were present or not.
Oh, I see. So he was saying what the landowner was doing might not be illegal. So that's where you first got that idea.
It might be illegal or might not be illegal. Yeah. He was saying, okay, we don't know yet.
Got it.
Yeah. So we sent out those letters. They went to Alaska Trails. Alaska Trails kind of helped us crunch the data. And then Tom looked at that and said, yeah, it looks pretty darn obvious to me, is what he was saying, that there is a prescriptive easement established by the history of use.
And a prescriptive public easement goes way back. It's like back into English common law since 1275, right?
Yep. Yeah. It's an old idea in law. Yeah.
And then it's also a central part of Western property rights. So it's been used a lot in the Western United States. Mm-hmm. And can you say off the top of your head, I'm sure you can, the three kind of like pillars of it?
Yeah. So three things have to be there for a prescriptive easement to be established. You have to have open, notorious, and hostile use. The first two are, what they sound like, open use, it's not concealed, continuous, which in Alaska law means 10 continuous years. Hostile is the tricky one, and that's where the court case sort of revolved around. But essentially, in this case, what hostile means is, hey, I went to the trail, I thought it was public, it seemed public to me, and I treated it as public, and I never asked for permission. And if those conditions were present, then it's legally meets the definition of hostile.
And the hostile part of it kind of goes way back to the Stuarts, right? Because was it Oro Stuart?
Yeah.
Right? Am I getting that was the wife, right? There were two Stuarts. And she had always said, I don't care who uses this land. I consider this to be open to the public and it makes no difference to me.
Yeah. She, you know, had a history of inviting people back, you know, come for walks. And in fact, when they passed away, they gave their land to split it up between the botanical gardens and the zoo. So, you know, they were pretty public minded people. Interestingly, super characters too. You know, they owned the Stuart Photo Shop. They had the first, star, you know, caribou,
right, the reindeer, yeah.
You know, that was one of the linchpins of the case was, you know, well, if they said, hey, come on over, all of you public people, then it wasn't hostile, right? Then it was an invited use. Mm-hmm. But essentially,
then that becomes actually sort like if she was specifically inviting people in, then that doesn't maybe line up with the prescriptive public easement, right?
Exactly.
Yeah.
So there was some trickiness to the case. But, you know, essentially what the court found and what our assertion was that, you know, she's the last landowner, right? She cannot give permission for people to walk across, you know, the two people who the lawsuit were, what was directed towards, there's nothing she can do to give people permission to walk across those parcels. So permission was not given to walk across those parcels. But regardless, you know, that was kind of so far in the past that, you know, there's some question about whether that is even applicable to 1970 or 1980 or 90 or the 2000s, you know? Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And then there was one of the landowners who the one who put up the gate, Frank, who put up the gate. Then he was trying to make it, wasn't he in some way trying to make it less hostile by have people sign off and say, oh, yeah, I'm here. And then Frank is saying, I'm giving you permission to be here or something like that.
Yeah, well, that's the antidote to hostile use, right?
Right.
If you give permission and it's explicit permission, then it's not hostile because you've given permission. Yeah. And, you know, everybody had the chance. Well, everybody that lived around here had the chance to sign that and then have access to the trail. But, you know, for us, the big problem was, you know, yeah, but what about someone who lives, you know, 4 miles away? They have a right to access this trail too, according to our, you know, our assertion.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So how long did you all, the friends ended up suing the two landowners?
Unfortunately.
Yeah. So when did you sue them? What year was that?
That's a good question. I think I've tried to block most of it out of my mind, but it was all of 3 years ago, I believe.
Oh, so it's taken this long for it to kind of wind through the system?
Oh, yeah. And before that, there was a long process of attempting mediation, and the Great Land Trust got involved and tried to, you know, help us as community members figure it out and find a creative solution. All of that failed. So
Was it a year or two of mediation? How does mediation work in something like this? You're bringing all the parties together, but you have two people, to the defendants, who are extremely hostile towards this happening.
Yeah. And mediation never got off the ground.
Okay.
various forms that we tried, you know, we tried meeting them in coffee shops, and I invited Mr. Pugh over here for a beer, and maybe we can just sit down as people and listen to each other. And Great Land Trust tried to create some bridges and some, you know, creative solutions. None of it ever really got off the ground.
Mm-hmm. I mean, I don't know if you feel comfortable answering this, but why do you think there's so much hostility from, well, specifically, well, I guess both of them, but one of them has lived on the property, but the other, Mr. Pugh, has not lived on the property. So why do you think that there was so much hostility to allowing this to continue as it had always been?
I don't know the answer to that. I don't think I know him well enough to be able to answer that. I from what I know of him, he believes quite strongly in what he believes, and you know, has the personality to move with some force on strong beliefs. So I think, you know, beyond that, I don't know. Honestly, it's a bit baffling why we couldn't sit down together and have more of a conversation and listen to each other. But, you know, that requires that we actually sort of listen and acknowledge that we each have, that we each hold beliefs and ideas that are legitimate and allow ourselves to be influenced by the other side, not just in our direction, but for us in his direction too. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I think that's one of the big, you know, sad tragedies of this story, is that we failed to do that as neighbors.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
It kind of feels like the country right now, doesn't it?
Absolutely.
Yeah. It really is like a story about the country.
Yeah. And I should say, you know, not everybody who didn't want the trail here has that failure, right? Mm-hmm. In fact, it's just, you know, maybe one or two people that have that failure, the inability to be able to sit and talk with someone who we disagree with. Most of the people who don't want the trail here are able and willing to sit down and talk. So I don't want to paint, you know, everybody with that brush.
Right. But again, it like goes back to what's happening in our country, is that very few people are almost holding everybody else hostage, you know, not willing to communicate and talk about things. So, okay, so the legal process and the mediation, the legal process, we're winding through this. And then at the end of August this year, the beginning of September, you get a judgment.
Yep. I believe I'd have to look back. I think it was the very beginning of September. Yeah.
Okay. And so let's talk about the judgment. What happened?
Yeah. So essentially the judge just handed down, I think it's like a 68 page judgment. It's quite comprehensive. Excuse me. And essentially she just said, yeah, that's, there's no doubt there's a prescriptive easement established by the history of use. Yeah.
And so how was that received by the friends? Everybody was pretty happy about that.
Yeah, we were pretty stoked. You know, we were quite certain that that's the direction it was going. It seemed obvious to us sort of all along, but especially the way the trial played out, it seemed quite clear. But you know, it's not in writing till it's in writing. So
right,
it was it was a big relief to have happened what we thought was going to happen, but it also opened this whole other chapter of work to be done. You know, the legal advocacy isn't over. It just sort of turned a page, and the practical the practical problems that it presents now that it's open, we have to start working on those now.
Mm-hmm. And the big piece of it is that here we are. So we're recording on November 4th.
Yep.
And the show might not run until the first part of January. But as of November 4th, the reinforced gate is still there.
Yeah. Right. The gears of justice turned very slowly.
And so of course there's an appeals process, and, and is it just one of the defendants has filed an appeal?
I believe that's the case. Yeah. It's not actually an appeal, but, so I didn't know this until we got all into it, but, so the judgment was handed down. The defendant has the opportunity to ask that the judge reconsider her decision. And essentially that's just, hey, we think you made a mistake. Here's why we think you made a mistake. Would you reconsider it? So they did that. We filed our response to their motion. So she has to decide whether she's going to reconsider the her decision that she made. I think it's pretty clear she's not, you know, that's not going to happen. The grounds for reconsideration just aren't there. But what it puts on hold is the final, I think it's called the final judgment. So what came down at the beginning of September was, yes, there is a prescriptive easement, but the way specifically that's applied and the mandate by the court isn't a part of that initial decision. Mm-hmm. So I think it's called a final judgment, but that is on hold now because we're going through the process of the defendants asking her to reconsider whether she made a mistake or not. Once that is settled, which should be just here in a matter of a couple of weeks, then she will move on to the task of deciding, well, what will the final judgment be? You know, how wide is the prescriptive easement? What does the access have to look like? You know, is it 4 feet wide? Is it 3 feet wide? You know, all of those very specific sort of decisions. And once she essentially makes that decision, then he will be mandated by the court, by the law, to do certain things like take the barrier down.
And potentially create some other kind of barrier so that pedestrians can get through, but not motor vehicles? Or like, is he going to be on the hook for some of that as well?
On the hook as in he has to do it?
Yeah, he has to do it. He has to pay for it.
Sure. Yeah, this is all his. It's his gate. It's his property. He's the one that put the barriers up. Yeah, it's going to be his responsibility to comply with what the judge, you know, decrees or says he needs to do.
And what happens if he doesn't do that?
I don't know. I guess we'll cross that bridge when we get to it. At that point, it's pretty straightforward and you know, I think legally easy stuff, you know, uh-huh. Like the judge told you got to do this, you got to do this.
Yeah. And you guys are feeling good enough about this that you had like a celebration this past weekend at Fire Island and receive more information from your attorneys and everything about what it's going to look like going forward.
Yeah, you bet. There was a lot to celebrate, you know. Mm-hmm. There were hundreds of people that supported us and with hundreds of thousands of dollars of their hard-earned money, you know.
Yeah.
I mean, this was a significant endeavor supported by, you know, a groundswell of people. And so there was a lot to celebrate, not the least of which being that initial decision.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And how much money between the two sides has been spent or will be spent? I mean, it was, like you said, very significant.
Yeah. I'm not the treasurer, so I can't give you, you know, super accurate numbers. And I have no idea what the defendants have spent, but yeah, our figures are in the multiple hundreds of thousands of dollars.
Wow. That's crazy. Yeah.
We're very, very grateful to, you know, some of the board members and some of the members of the public have just been just very generous and committed to, you know, to reestablishing this right for the public.
Mm-hmm. So finally, Do you have any advice to neighborhoods that are trying to protect public asset access, and or maybe just something in their neighborhood that's always happened and now has been shut down, or maybe even something new that they want that they aren't seem to be unable to get?
That's a good question. I suppose my first advice would be just, you know, call a lawyer, and, you know, one well-versed in land use rights, and become informed about what the law in Alaska says. And I guess from there, people can make a decision about what they want to advocate for, if they want to go through that time and effort. And yeah.
I mean, it's been quite the struggle for you guys to do this, but you said in lots of ways, like, you've met people you've never met before, your neighbors, found common ground with a lot of your neighbors, made compromises or admitted things, you know, to try to bring people together.
Yeah.
Right.
Oh yeah, for sure. I mean, you know, honestly, I don't know, when we were sitting around the table writing all those letters, if you would have told me, hey, this is what you're going to be in for this many years and this much money. I don't know that we would have sent those letters out. I like to think that we would have, but you're right. Part of the benefit is that, you know, we drew some people closer into our lives that I'm just very grateful to have been able to spend that time with and share this burden with. And, you know, that's meaningful.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Well, thanks so much for breaking all this down for me today, Chris. I mean, I think it was really not just the whole, like, you know, public access piece of it that's so important to most Alaskans to get to our wild spaces that are right here, but also just the process of doing it and, you know, how you kind of have to gather your neighborhood together if there's something you feel really strongly about.
Mm, yeah, you bet. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, thanks a bunch. You are listening to Outdoor Explorer on Alaska Public Media. I'm your host, Lisa Keller. We're going to take a short break, and when we return, we'll hear from Kelly Becker, a homeowner living adjacent to the Stuart Trail.
You're listening to Outdoor Explorer on Alaska Public Media. Find the show anytime as a free podcast in the iTunes Store, or connect with us online at alaskapublic.org.
You are listening to Outdoor Explorer on Alaska Public Media. I'm your host, Lisa Keller. My guest in the next segment is Kelly Becker, a homeowner living adjacent to the Stuart Trail. Welcome to Outdoor Explorer, Kelly.
Thank you, Lisa.
And I'm really glad that you decided that you wanted to join me and talk about the issue with Stuart Trail. I've actually, years and years ago on a New Year's Eve, I was up at your house and we sledded down your driveway, which is very, very long, and had a great time. And at that time, none of this stuff was going on, right?
Well, the beginnings were going on, but
okay.
It was not apparent at the time that things were brewing at that
yeah.
time.
So you live very close to the trail. So you've been very impacted since you've lived in your house for like 20 years now.
Yes. I've lived in this house, 20 years. And then we lived, two houses down in a smaller house off a steamboat. My husband bought it when we were dating, and then we got married and had our three kids and outgrew that house.
Okay.
And moved up here in 2020. I mean, 2002.
Yeah. There's lots of twos going on right now.
2002. Oh boy. Yeah.
It goes fast, Kelly, doesn't it?
It does.
You know what? Coming to think about it, that's the house I might have been at, was the one on Steamboat. Because I think my kids were really little, and your kids were, maybe you just had your boys at that point.
No, you know what? I know it was the Mountainside Village one here, or this house.
So what was it like when you moved in 2002 in terms of, did you have very many neighbors? Was there very much action going on with the Stuart Trail? Did people use it a lot or not?
Well, that's okay. That when we moved in, when Russ bought the house on Steamboat when we were dating. We used to mountain bike up the trail, and it was, you know, it was really overgrown, kind of aldery, you know, Lisa, but, you know, we would hike and ride our bikes and stuff. And then, you know, toward the end of the 90s, I'm not sure what year, you know, that's when this gate, the red gate went up. See, everyone thinks Frank put the gate up, but the gate and the color of the gate, which Jeff and Paxson were, you know, commenting on Frank's gate color, which he had nothing to do with that, but the gate was there. And because back then it was kind of scary, Lisa, kids would come up and they would party, and, or they'd come up Mountainside Village and, you know, park on undeveloped cul-de-sacs and things like that. You know, there weren't all these homes up here then. And so it was a very common party place. And so anyway, when we bought this house, you know, Helen, you know, had a key to that gate, and she gave it to me. And she said, you know, we don't want vehicle traffic, but, you know, the owners are fine with people hiking up there. And she gave me a key, and she said, you know, if somebody needs something, you know, if somebody needs to go drive up there, like if somebody needs something, or, you know, give them the key and they can, you know, and open the gate. And I remember being kind of stressed by that, because I was like, well, what if I'm not home, you know? And it makes me laugh, Lisa, because one time there was a fire truck, and I ran down there. I go, I have a key if you need to get in there. And he goes, ma'am, if we need to get in there, we're just going to ram it. And I go, oh, okay. You know what I mean, Lisa? But there was a kind of sense of, oh gosh, I have a key to the gate. You know, I what am I going to do if somebody needs something?
You felt a lot of responsibility to make sure that, you know, vehicles weren't going up there and.
Yeah. I mean, it at that time, you know, hikers were permitted, but they didn't want, you know, the partiers, because, you know, so that's that the original, you know, group of homeowners, that's how this started in my eyes, Lisa, is, you know, and we had trails coming across up our property also. So it was just kind of an unwritten thing. You know, people were hiking down mainly from the neighborhood down below and our neighborhood, you know, people would kind of mill around up from Paradise, you know, Valley. And so, but it was a hiking trail, Lisa, and it wasn't used that much. So that's how it was when we bought this house. There was not cars parked down below. You might see one or two, you know what I mean, Lisa? But it really didn't stand out. I mean, I'm right here.
Probably a lot of people that were coming up to friends' houses and parking in their driveways because they were their friends. You know, they were allowed in going hiking with people who lived around there and everything. Cause I mean, and I asked my brother this when we went and hiked it. I'm like, did we ever come up here as kids? And he said, no, we never came up here as kids. He goes, I don't ever remember us coming and hiking this trail. So for me, it was a brand new thing. And, you know, as you know, my family hiked a lot through the 60s, 70s and 80s, you know?
Right. Right. And I didn't use it as well until we moved up here, you know? So, you know, I always felt I had permission, you know what I mean? Because Helen told me, and then, you know, my mom knew Letty, she volunteered at the craft shop with my mom, you know what I'm saying, mm-hmm. Lisa? So
right.
The mom knows, oh, Letty used to go up there all the time and, you know, they don't mind. And, you know, so I always had a permissive use feeling. And I tried really hard to respect, you know, those wishes. Now, you know, as Craig Medred pointed out, yes, I have snow machines, and yes, we may have gone up there a few times. Actually, we did, Lisa. We towed the kids up to do the some skiing and stuff. But in the 20 years that we've lived in this house and things, it's a handful. It's very few. You can't do it, Lisa. You know, it's very visible. So we didn't do it that often. You know, it was literally on one hand. So
the Craig Medrid article did make it sound like you were continuously running snow machines and four-wheelers up there, and it was your own private paradise. But as you even said, you towed the kids, which means this was a long time ago. They were little when right. you did it, and it wasn't often.
Well, and it wasn't, we going up our driveway is one thing, you know, like we used mm-hmm. to sled, and then they, when they were little, like when we had that party, we would put them on a, we'd pull them up with a sled. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? If you
right,
remember.
Right. Yes. So, I remember that. Yep. But, that was the highlight. The kids love that more than going down. Right. They like getting towed back up.
Right. So, anyway, but as far as going back on the Stewart Trail, you know, Frank had permitted it, you know, in later years, but you know, you didn't necessarily have permission from all the landowners. But that made it sound like we did that a lot, and we did not. And, you know, this goes into another thing that I think is quite, I don't know if it's toxic, but, you know, Craig Medrid wrote in that article that your neighbors were disappointed in you tearing up the trail. What neighbors? I know my neighbors, you know, intimately from around this trail. You know, some of them have even driven on it, not very often, Lisa, but you know what I mean? I know that like one of them got a new four-wheeler or something and they went up there, you know what I mean? And mm-hmm. and somebody, you know, like one of them had a son and I think he went for a little spin on it. It's really not that fun to ride back there. You don't go anywhere. So, I mean, it's, you right. don't, unless you want to tow and try to ski, but that is not, you know that this is private property. Now, when the Beesecker's moved in, Russ did plow their road, plow the trail back to their house.
Right. And so to be clear, there are a couple of houses back there or dwellings that people live yeah. in. So those people do have to go through that gate with their vehicle to get to their home, right?
They do. Michael was, you know, he was kind of injured or whatever. So Russ did plow the road with, you know, we have a side-by-side. And then it was, you know, it was get too much snow and too difficult. So, mm-hmm. you know, he only did that, I don't know, he did that three times or so. But anyway, so he did use our ATV for that. But anyway, that's setting the record straight and mm-hmm. and viewing the hikers as interlopers or whatever he said. I haven't talked to the man, and I that is not true. Mm-hmm. And what was more upsetting, Lisa, is it was linked to the donations for, you know, like you have the Friends of Stewart Trail getting donations, and I donated to Frank's cause. Right. And but Lisa, you know, it wasn't much. I ultimately decided that, you know, it's his land, it's, you know, he's got to defend or, you know, stand for his land and, you know, figure that out himself. I would give him my time and, you know, kind of support. I understood where he was coming from.
So how did your relationship with Frank first start? Did you, when he bought the property or when all of this started bubbling up?
Well, I mean, we, you know, the for sale sign went away and you're like, okay. So then you get word that it's purchased, and he put a no trespassing sign, you know, or like, enter at your own risk, I think, you know, no trespassing, because I mean, and I, so that caught my attention. I was like, oh, wow, you know, but Lisa, this isn't foreign to me. Other people have bought land up above and I lost, but you know, we couldn't go up there anymore. Do you know what I mean?
Because right, you didn't have access anymore because it's private property. Yeah.
Right. But I mean, and then one guy didn't want it anymore. So I get it. I understand because mm-hmm. We've lost other access points. So I do understand, you know, the desperation or, you know, the anger with this being shut down. And he he was doing that to protect himself, you know, legally, you know, if somebody has a problem on his property. So anyway, so then all of a sudden, you know, the Chugach access plan.
Right.
You know, somebody was talking about that, and I still had the kids and I was busy working and raising my family. And they're like, Kelly, they're looking at this as an access point to the park. And I'm like, what? Oh, that's interesting. So I went down to the assembly meeting, and it was there that I'm all, oh, wow. This, they're not just look, this is a beacon, you know, it's got a lighthouse, you know, like a flashing red light, Lisa.
Right.
And so I'm like, Russ, wow. You know, it started to get my attention then. And, but after they started that process, then it was out there, Lisa, you know what I mean? Because Chugach access plan. So then the crowds came.
Oh, so once everybody heard about this, it was before the assembly, all of a sudden, because just like all of us growing up in here, very few of us had ever gone up there. We didn't know about it. Now, all of a sudden, everybody knows about it.
Yes. And thank you, Lisa.
Yeah.
That's exactly my perspective. Mm-hmm. Okay. So now more cars, more people, and more emboldened people. Because, you know, we used to just, you know, people would be hiking and, you know, kind of milling around, but nothing too intrusive, Lisa. Mm-hmm. But then, you know, like we used to set up these little bow and arrows for our kids, you know, like, you know, we have a shed over there. It's totally on our property. There's a bank, you know, it's very safe. In fact, and, you know, we put these little things up and they'd shoot their little bows and arrows. Well, what happens, and I am guilty of this myself. So again, Lisa, I'm trying not to be a Karen here. You know, like when you go on a trail and you get kind of lost and you come out, God only knows where. That has happened to me. Okay. And it happened to me up here a time or two, you know, where you're hiking around up there. And I had, the kids are small and they're getting tired. And I'm like, oh boy. So, I mean, I've come down this driveway up above, and actually we became friends with them. They had kids the same age, but it was embarrassing. You know, you're like, oh, sorry. I'm cutting through your driveway, but I got to get my kids down, you know. Anyway, that got to be very challenging for Russ and I.
Yeah, you had a story about somebody who parked at the bottom of your driveway, and then you were coming down and it was dark and a little bit icy. Can you tell that story?
Well, that one, there's two of them, Lise. One of them, you know, I took the kids to swim lessons, you know, all three of them. And then you're coming up and their hair's wet. And someone had parked in our driveway, literally at the base of our driveway. So I'm like, so I called Russ. I said, honey, I'm home with the kids. They're all wet. They were little or, you know, not totally little, but, you know, they're still lower grade school. And you're just like, can you come down and help me get the kids up? And so he comes down and he was mad. He's like, what is going on? Why? This is clearly a driveway. So he went down. What did he do? He put my car blocking them leaving our driveway. So he put my car, took me and the kids up the driveway. And a little while later, a guy comes and knocks on our door and he goes, you're blocking me. What, you know, and Russ goes, you blocked our driveway. And sorry. And
well, that to me is the huge safety thing. Cause if a fire truck was going to try to get through there, it would be very difficult for a fire truck to get through there.
Right. And that's the biggest concern with this current decision is, you know, we have, everyone's getting older, myself included, but we have some older people that live in the neighborhood and they're very terrified because, you know, they've all experienced this lack of access. Mm-hmm. And so anyway, Lisa, that, you know, that's what happened is just the expanding use. And then there was a hiking blogger, you know, Russ was like, what is going on? Why is this exploding? And he got online and we Googled MEQ and, you know, and we found a hiking blogger and he had our street and everything on his blog. And so we called him, we're like, hey, can you take this down? You know, this, and he even wrote in his blog that the landowners have been friendly so far, you know, but that could change, you know, and
Like, be respectful of the landowners, right?
Right, right. Yeah. And so anyway, so we reached him. He goes, well, I'm not going to respond to you. You have to get the owner to ask me to not do this. And I go, okay. So, you know, we reached out to Frank and said, hey, can you try to work with this guy to get this off his blog? The usage of this trail is exploding. I mean, I just can't explain it, Lisa. It just starts to whittle away at your goodwill. And then when people get nasty with you, then you know, you start to get more grumpy back. I do want people to understand that a lot of attempts of trying to get this done were failed in the past, and they continue to fail, Lisa. Mm-hmm. I mean, just so you know, like, the judge ruled, I don't agree with her ruling. Mm-hmm.
And her ruling was that it is public access, and yeah, public access needs to be allowed. And so then now the next step is having to open up the gate in some manner, but that hasn't been figured out yet. Right.
Right. And I don't, you know, that all has to be figured out, Lisa. You know, yeah, we have to respect her ruling. We don't have to agree with it, but that's what I'm saying. Like, okay, immediately I don't agree, but this is what I call it, emotional intelligence. We can have we had a fight. You know what I mean? There's a ruling, and now we have to work together to try to come to some, you know, we have to live with this or agree with this. Does that make sense?
It does. And what would you like to see happen at this point, assuming that, and there are a couple more legal maneuverings to go through, but let's just assume that this is all going forward. The gate is going to be changed or removed or made available for pedestrian access. What would be the next steps that you would like to see to deal with the crush of crowds that is probably coming?
Right. Well, and Lisa, the big thing with the gate has been there since the, you know, late 90s.
I'm right. Sure. And the gate seems to be important, that there can't just be random cars driving up there, because right, there have been buildings set on fire up there. And like you said, it could become another party central, and nobody wants to see that.
Well, in 2016, that campfire that was unattended, you know, there's too many, it's too close to housing, Lisa.
Right.
You know, that McEwen, I mean, I was looking at flames coming over that thing, and we were getting ready to kind of evacuate.
Which is another parking issue. Like, if you had people parked on your road, it would be difficult to evacuate out of that neighborhood if everybody's trying to get out and there are already hikers. And this is a scenario that I think is going to happen more and more in Anchorage, that we're going to have those fires up in our mountains and that people are going to need to get out.
And that is my biggest fear, Lisa, is honestly, is yes. And so after the ruling, I thought, okay, we'll be constructive with this. We've got to figure this out. Mm-hmm. And, you know, just, I have neighbors that are upset and they're worried about the parking and the access. And then you have the trail users, you know, that are just, let's go, we're going to show those rich people, you know. And so I was trying to get ahead of this, Lisa, because I don't want to be a Karen. Okay. Mm-hmm. I don't want to be down there, you know, no, you can't park here, that's not safe. So I immediately set about, okay, we're going to be right back where we were, and then some, because this, I mean, it was not a public trail per se, Lisa, like it is going to be now. It was not that before. So, and I have front row seating, you know what I mean?
I don't, and
this is where we can agree to disagree. I mean, I have people going, it is a public trail. The judge said okay, that's fine, but it was not public like it is going to be now, you know? So I started working with the parking authority. I reached out to Randy Saltz, the assembly. Mm-hmm. I'm reaching out to APD. You know, I'm trying to, okay. So from a fire perspective, I wanted the people that are, you know, in charge of that aspect of our city to tell me how many cars, you know, like if we get a wildfire, how many, see, to me, Lisa, we already have all these homes up here, and And I attended this fire egress meeting about a month or so ago, Lisa. They don't even know how they're going to get people down. Honestly, they're trying to come up with a plan. But that's my concern is, okay, we already funnel down these little roads. Okay. Then you funnel onto Golden View, one road. And then, you know, Rabbit Creek, you can start to kind of go down through Golden View. You can start to, you know, wiggle your way down some streets. But this up here scares me, Lisa, almost every spring. Until we get a bunch of rain, I sit here and just go, oh my gosh. And so this next summer, depending on the trail opening, honestly, I'm terrified because, you know, if we get these cars, how are we all going to get down?
When we were kids in the 70s, you remember the big fire on the hillside? It was up around Prospect. It was like, if you're going up to Prospect, it was that road that runs up after you go up Upper O'Malley. Hope I'm getting these roads right, but it's the road that you go all the way and it tees and then you take a left and then you can get to the Prospect Heights trailhead.
Like Trails End or something like that.
Yeah, it's Trails End. Right. Exactly. Yeah. There was a huge fire up there. I mean, I remember it clearly because we were little, but my dad went up because the community went up to fight the fire, you know? And, there were very few houses up there during that time. And now it's like, boom, we're like sitting like California, you know, in terms of we've gone into fire country. Well, fire country is being created here because of climate change and it's going to happen. A hillside fire is going to happen.
Well, that's what the fire chief told me years ago, you know, when, before all this happened, you know, we started to meet with the fire chief, you know, they kind of come up and do their rounds and, you know, he comes up and he goes, yeah, this isn't safe, you know, because they've been up there when the roads are, you know, congested and he said, and it's not if, it's when. Right. And so I'm like, so how do we manage this? And that's been my question since the judge ruled on this. In my opinion, you know, it's not that access isn't important, Lisa, but to me, they should let this stuff happen organically. You know, when this was a trail, there were not houses up there. I mean, Michael and, you know, they're driving that. So like, if you're hiking, hello there, they're driving on it now. You know what I mean? It's lost a little bit of its allure to me because, you know, people are driving on it. They access their homes and there's more people buying land up there all the time. So there's going to be more and more homes. So this trail is changing to more of a little driveway or, you know,
are you looking at places where there could be, parking maybe lower and people can walk up? Although ironically, I know people don't like to walk up to their trail, which is so funny. It's like, oh no, yes, I have to walk a quarter mile.
Yes. And, yes, I am looking because I want to give people options. I don't want to say there's no parking here, you know, go away. That isn't going to work.
Right.
You know, and
because they're coming, they're coming.
Right. Exactly. So, and I know this. So it's like, okay, I'm reaching out to the professionals to say where is it legally and, you know, safe to park. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean, Lisa?
Right.
So I'm putting my energy toward that. I'm working with the Friends of Stewart Trail. They're having a parking committee.
I heard that you were on the stewardship committee. That's what I heard.
Right. Yes.
That's really great. So you're on the stewardship committee of the Friends of the Stewart Trail. So you are now working with the people that you were fighting against, which I really like because you stood up for what you believed in. They're standing up for what they believed in, but now you guys are working on coming together to get these main issues solved.
It has to be this way, Lisa. But I'm working with this group, although they're having some problems, you know, they're not, you know, like they reached out and said, we're having some board, you know, meetings or blah, blah, blah. So they're moving pretty slowly on this. Mm-hmm. And I've got two hats. I'm trying to constructively look at this for my neighborhood. And then, you know, if they can, you know, get their board or whatever their issues, you know, I told them I would help with that aspect of the Stewart Trail, you know, the committee. But they're moving pretty slow. And I want to be ready, Lisa, because if the judge comes back, you know, if these legal things, the trail will be open. Mm-hmm. And I would like to get ahead of this and do a massive public reach out, education, and say, you know, help this be successful. Can we try to work together? And you guys park, you know, I'm going to do my best, or we're going to do our best to identify spots. And if you would be respectful of those spots. And then, yes, some of them are quite far away, Lisa. There is no parking, safe legal parking right here at this trailhead. That has always been my, you know, from way back when I was like, what are we going to do? I mean, if you come up here this is going to be a year round trail, you know what I mean? Yeah. But when in the wintertime they plow the snow, it already gets very narrow, Lisa. You know what I mean? So give me your opinion. I think we should identify spots that could be pretty non-problematic year round. I mean, because I think if you say, well, you can park here sometimes, but not, I don't know what the answer is, but
I agree with you, having been up there this summer, that the parking is very concerning, and the ability to get people out of there if there's a lot of people parked there, or to get an emergency vehicle up if somebody is in distress, is a real issue that needs to be solved.
Yes.
Well, it sounds like there's still disagreements, but that all of you, from listening to all of you, seem to be on the road to trying to come together to make the best possible solution to this. And that's really the message that you and I have talked about, you know, a couple months ago when we talked about this, and that we really need to talk to each other in a respectful way. And now you guys are all moving forward, and it seems like trying to make the best of it for both sides.
It is. That in a nutshell is where we're at.
Well, thanks so much for joining me today, Kelly. It's been a great conversation, and I really enjoyed hearing you talk about, like, what I think is a very important issue, and also that you can accept something that you don't necessarily agree with, but then you want to look for solutions. So I think that's really the important thing.
It is. It is. Yeah.
Thanks, Kelly.
Thanks for your time.
That's it for today's show. Thanks to my guests, Chris Reynolds and Kelly Becker. You can find links to the Friends of the Stewart Public Trail, the ruling on the civil lawsuit, and the Craig Medrid article on the Outdoor Explorer page on alaskapublic.org. The show is produced by Eric Bork. My name is Lisa Keller, and from all of our hosts here at Outdoor Explorer, thanks for listening, and we'll see you outside.
Outdoor Explorer is a production of KSKA Public Radio in Anchorage, Alaska. Theme music is by Portugal, The Man. Views expressed are those of the participants and do not reflect the station or its underwriters. You can find Outdoor Explorer on Facebook and in your favorite podcast app. To see what's coming up on Outdoor Explorer and add your voice to the conversation, go to our website at alaskapublic.org.
Life Informed. This is Alaska Public Media.